welcome to the second episode of Sevens Up, the MS51 literary podcast written and produced entirely by seventh grade students. We're your hosts, Maya,
Alex,
and Ula, and we want to start by saying
thank you. Our pilot episode had over 300 listeners on Audioboom and iTunes, and we're thrilled to be back on the air.
Today, you're going to be hearing two narrative pieces written by 7th grade students, along with some Q&A sessions with the authors. You'll also be hearing an op-ed piece about the changing face of our currency, another grammar-based public service announcement, and a newly revamped debate segment over whether or not buildings dedicated to historical figures with questionably racist viewpoints should be renamed according to today's ethical standards.
Following this episode's Person on the Street section and two brand new book reviews, you'll hear an extended segment on a very important issue that has affected every single person in the world at least once. The complicated subject of bullying. Is the word bullying too broad? Is it just a mask of a word that we use to conceal the darker side of everyone's nature? You'll hear anonymous writing pieces on the subject written by current and former MS51 students and teachers. Finally, Maya and I will sit down with a panel of 7th grade students who came together one day to discuss their thoughts on the bullying epidemic.
And now here's Ula.
Today you'll be hearing two narrative writing pieces from our recent writing units on memoir and real fiction. That is, fiction based on actual historical and social events. Here's Lucy Blum, who will be introducing our first featured author.
Hi, I'm Lucy Blum, and I will be introducing author Allie Puccio, who wrote a memoir about her grandmother who has Alzheimer's.
I'm shivering because it is cold, even for Christmas time in North Carolina. You wouldn't like it. I am facing your house. I'm longing to see you inside, and I know if you remembered, you would want to be inside too. You don't know who I am anymore, but I visit you with my family. I am the girl with the dark hair. I am your granddaughter. I am staring at a big sold sign stuck in a patch of grass outside your house. My mom, who is your daughter, my brother, my dad, and dog are all here. You did know us and you did love us. You still know we are important to you, but you can't say exactly why. That's okay. We still love you and we know why. We love you because you are kind and funny and loving. Inside, you still are. I'm thinking about how I'm supposed to be thankful your house is being sold. The place you're in now is called a nursing home. You have been there for 2 years. Without you here at your house, there is no point in keeping it. We are not only selling your house, but we are selling all the memories we made inside it. I don't know if there are real memories anymore because you don't remember them. Maybe, though, if you dug really deep down inside yourself, you could remember bits and pieces of them. Maybe then those pieces could fit together and our memories could become whole again. My mother is walking ahead of me and unlocking your door with a spare key. I am remembering, all of a sudden, a different key. It was Christmas break 3 years ago, the last Christmas break we had together in your house. I'd found this beautiful key in an old box in the room I slept in when I came to see you with my family. It was the old-fashioned kind, with two metal prongs coming out of a metal bar. The metal prongs were worn in like it had been used many times. It didn't have a single flaw. I'm walking into your house now, following my mom. The emptiness is hitting me so hard. It is like a wave. I'm walking through your entryway and through your empty living room. Now I am running through your empty kitchen. I am realizing these places aren't yours anymore. I am trying to run away from the emptiness, but I am running into it. I'm becoming determined to find that old key. I remember when I brought the key to you. I wanted to know what the key could open. I didn't want to think something so beautiful did not have a purpose. Grandma, I asked you, do you know what this key is for? You looked confused. You seemed to be searching for something deep inside your brain. The gears were turning, but not enough. Allie, you had said, I'm not quite sure. With that, you turned away. Your eyes looked distant and saw that the key was more than worn down. On the edges, rust was beginning to show. I am running through your hallway until I am in my old room. My bed is gone. I am afraid to look to my right. I am afraid there will be no dresser. I am afraid that the old box holding the key won't be there. I am afraid because I know that if you understood why all of your things are gone, if you knew that this place used to be your home and that your belongings are being sold, you would do everything you could to stop it. I am turning my head. I am being enveloped by emptiness. The four huge white walls seem to be confining me. I'm letting my eyes fall down the wall that should be hidden by your old dresser. My eyes are being caught on a pile of papers. The walls seem to be widening just enough to let in hope. I am hopeful that this unwanted, unnecessary pile of papers contains everything I want and need. I am being drawn towards the pile. My hands have landed on the papers, which must be from a long time ago. These papers were important. That is why they're being saved. But you don't remember them. I'm thinking about how I am important to you. I am your granddaughter, but you don't remember my name. I'm wondering if that is all I mean to you now. I'm wondering if all the different things inside me that mean something have left your mind and your heart. I am mindlessly taking the top piece of paper off the pile and crumpling it along with the thought. I'm seeing that this is not a pile of papers at all. Underneath the piece of paper, looking more beautiful than ever, is that dusty, dented box, the one that holds your key. I'm opening the box. I'm looking at the key. I'm taking the key out of the box and holding it in my hand. I wouldn't let the key slip away unaware of its purpose, too. When we left later that week, I couldn't stop thinking about the key or about you. I'm turning the key over in my hand. A thought is creeping into my head. I'm thinking that the key I'm holding is unaware of its purpose, is oblivious to the fact that it could open something. It doesn't know at one point it was a beautiful silver. I'm thinking that maybe then the key is content. I'm realizing I'm not thinking about the key. I'm thinking about you. You have already let go. I am the one that is afraid. Something is being unlocked inside me. The key's rust may now be exposed, but that doesn't change what it once could do. You may not know my name anymore, but at one point you said it full of love. It may seem like I have lost you on the outside, but I will always know where to find you. All I have to do is look inside myself.
So did this topic come to you quickly?
Well, I knew I wanted to write about my grandmother when I heard about the memoir project, but I wasn't sure how to express everything I wanted to say into a short story. But soon I realized I didn't have to tell a story about a certain event that happened between my grandmother and me, but I could write to her instead and still convey my feelings. I think the hardest part of writing this was knowing that my grandmother wouldn't ever be able to read it or understand it. In the beginning, I was also hesitant to write about her because I would have to face all the things I didn't want to think about. However, it wasn't until I started writing and sorting out my feelings that I realized maybe my grandmother is content because she doesn't know what she is losing.
I'm Maya Kendall, one of the hosts of this podcast. The next piece you'll be hearing was written by Oscar Phillips in 705. He wrote a fantastic review on an article about the new idea of putting a woman on United States currency. Oscar fully believes that women should be honored for what they've done by being put on currency. He also thinks that sexism won't be abolished by putting a woman on paper bills. Women will still be treated as they are less important to men. As awful as it may be, putting their face on a dollar bill will not put an end to this disgusting behavior.
New York Times' Upfront magazine, Alessandra Potenza, wrote a recently featured article called Joining the Men's Club. The article is about the long overdue struggle to put a woman on an American non-coin form of currency, a dollar bill. It's obvious there is sexism in the United States, not as glaring or as horrible as there is in other countries, but it's still there. Women do not earn the same pay as men for the same work, and no women exist on any of the paper bills. In fact, possible rapists, slave owners, and Native American killers all have places on the United States currency. No women do. It's kind of appalling. Famed abolitionists and civil rights movers all deserve places on the dollars just floating around, but they have largely been denied simply because of their sex. The fact that no women are on U.S. currency is not even as literal as that. The people on U.S. dollars and bills are the founders and the important people. So by not allowing any women on the bills, the government is implying that throughout U.S. history, no women were that important. That's really despicable. Women are still underpaid, which to me is far more important. Also, as far as slave owners like George Washington and a Native American killer like Andrew Jackson, they have their place on the money, not for those horrible reasons, but for their good achievements. If the U.S. continues to question its founders because they weren't great moral people, there will be no founders left to question. Washington was a slave owner, Ben Franklin was an adulterer, and Christopher Columbus killed thousands of natives. If people question their places in U.S. history, but Trump is somehow the Republican candidate, America might actually be declining. Personally, I would much rather see Rosa Parks on my $20 bill than Andrew Jackson.
It's Maya presenting Carter with another very important public service announcement.
Everyone's had that dream where they're standing in front of a large crowd or on stage alone and they realize something extremely embarrassing, like they aren't wearing pants or they've shrunk by 3 feet or they have a bright pink reverse mohawk. Thankfully, these horrible, disgusting, and at times tasteless things are confounded to our dreams, yet nearly everyone messes up speaking, not necessarily to an audience, but just stating something in general. No, I'm not talking about something along the lines of talking to your best friend and then revealing a terrible giant secret you were trying to hide. I'm talking about the speaking itself, not what you're saying, specifically when you have to think carefully about what to say. Usually it ends up with you saying something similar to, oh, well, you see, it's like, et cetera, when you mean to say something that's more clear and crisp and straight to the point. However, that's never the case, because while speaking, we doubt ourselves, we forget things, and if we stopped speaking while trying to gather ourselves, it would make for an extremely awkward pause in the middle of a sentence that would inevitably end up in discomfort, strange eye contact, and probably a bit of embarrassment on the speaking end. So instead, we just say things like, and like, and so, to either prove that a thought is being developed or to further justify a point. And we've done this so much that it's been proven difficult to say a statement without using one of these words, not counting dialogue, similes, or using like as a verb. And this is not good. It's been established that overusing any word can be annoying, sound strange, or make it lack meaning, but saying and like are especially bad, not just for the fact that they're unnecessary, if you know what you're saying, but also because it makes you sound a bit slow, daft, a little thick in the noggin from a business standpoint. They're like crutches for a sprained ankle. They support you, but they're not really necessary and don't really help your appearance. Well, verbal, that is. But don't worry. Saying too much won't give you a large, bushy, oily unibrow. So, you may be saying, how do I stop saying and like? The answer to that is that there are many ways. A popular one is putting a rubber band around your wrist and snapping it every time you say the word in question. The same can be done with an electric dog collar, but it's not recommended. Another way is simply to plan out what you'll say and how you'll say it so that there aren't as many moments of uncertainty. For those who like awkward situations, make eye contact whenever you speak. Saying when looking directly at someone can be a bit odd. Not only does stopping yourself from saying, like, so, and other words like them help you sound smoother, it helps in the long run. If you're doing a presentation in high school, making a speech, talking to a professor in college, being in a meeting where you're talking to cold-hearted business executives who eat watery, gray, lumpy oatmeal for breakfast, or even just chatting with friends, removing unnecessary words can make you sound much more fluent. With that final word, I would like to wish luck to anyone trying to stop saying words that are like, filler? Dang it.
Hello, my name is Simon Leitner, and I'm your host for I'm Right, You're Wrong, the debate section of this podcast. Today's debate is about whether or not colleges should continue to honor famous racist alumni based on the upfront article, Rethinking History, by Alessandra Potenza. Today we have Willem Meisner, who believes colleges should stop honoring famous racist alumni, and we also have Leonardo Carini, who believes colleges are free to honor them however they like. Willa will go first. Willa, take it away.
Of statues and streets and buildings and schools are named after people. MS-51 even was named after William Alexander. Presidents are important, and Princeton University in New Jersey has every right to honor the 28th president of the USA who attended Princeton by naming some things after him, except one reason. The 28th president of the United States of America, named Woodrow Wilson, had some views on race. When he was president, he said some very offensive things, including some things about how segregation is a benefit and whatnot. Now, many years later, people are protesting that the school is worshiping him and his racism too much. Being a diverse school meant that anything racist-related should not be made into a legacy. I agree with the protesters. Being the white, all-American person that I am, I can't say much, but I am against racism. People should all be treated the same based on the color of our skin. Princeton, as said in the passage, shouldn't be turning Wilson into some sort of god. It's an interesting fact to share that a president attended your school, but maybe Princeton has overdone itself this time. The topic of racism is a topic that interests me quite a bit, and one aspect of racism is that of stereotypes. There are endless stereotypes about race, whether it's rich white people, poor black people, smart Asians, dumb Americans, the list can go on and on. So although true beliefs that black and white people should be separated, or racism in general, are vanished, stereotypes are inevitable to return. After we get rid of all of our racist thoughts and words and actions, stereotypes will still and yet get in the way of a perfect society. So in conclusion, I think that Princeton should be less honoring of Wilson, but I also think that the change won't say much in what's left of racism in our country.
Next, we have Leonardo.
I don't think it's right to take down pictures and change names of schools because the alumni was a racist. I don't think racist alumni should be idolized, but schools shouldn't change dramatically because of them. Demanding public affairs school and residential complex to be renamed doesn't make sense. Everyone has flaws, whether it's your opinions or something you did wrong, but it doesn't mean you're shunned or demoted. Many founding fathers and other colonial leaders had slaves. If great leaders and people who have helped our nation in other ways were racist, why should they be taken off? I do agree that Wilson's racist views and beliefs should be recognized and noted by the school. Schools such as the University of Virginia, they see the flaws and wrongs of the past, and then they show that by making it part of their school's image. Don't tear down Wilson's legacy recklessly. I think it's important that we should use this chance that an alumni was both racist and did great things for our country. The school should use this opportunity to teach the students about the both good and bad things of the past. They should use this by going through the alumni. In general, I think that the school should have a healthy balance of both positives and negatives of the alumni.
Now, Willa and Leonardo will discuss the topic further.
You can learn about about the times in different ways, not just about the civil rights movement, not just about the people who were for the civil rights movement, but for the people who were against it. You usually only see one side, which is the side of the victor, and I think it'd be very beneficial if students learn about the side of the less favored choice or point of view.
I completely agree with you, except I think that students should learn about the history of their school, not because the person, the alumni, was a racist, but to learn. But I don't think that they should at all honor or support or agree with what the person did. It's just important to learn about your school, learn from what the person, and of course it's super cool that a president went to your school, and it's cool to know that, but I think that since the school is now completely diverse, I think that they should honor this racist person less.
Well, I don't think that they should honor at all his racist points of views, but there are things about Woodrow Wilson that were, he did great things for his country, but he also did things that are not seen as correct today, and I don't think that they're correct. I don't believe anybody in our neighborhood or anybody in our school believes these things were correct.
Right.
He
won the Nobel Peace Prize.
No, I'm trying to find bad things.
Oh, the bad things?
Yeah.
He segregated the government in 1913.
Well, I don't think, I agree with you. I don't think that those things are good, and I completely disagree with them. But this is exactly what I'm talking. He segregated the government in 1913, you said, right?
Yeah.
This is exactly what you can use this stuff to educate the students about that time period.
But that doesn't mean that this person should be worshipped or
I am completely
be turned into some kind of god. If you were to even learn about that, which you should, you shouldn't be connecting it. I mean, you said that you should be connecting it to what you're learning about.
It doesn't mean that they have to connect to his racist points of views and say, oh, I think that I should be racist too because Woodrow Wilson was racist. No, I'm saying that they
do that. It's just that he's so important in that school, and I think that you should learn about it, but you shouldn't get into it any farther than he was racist, because then he's just
I think you're wasting a learning opportunity if you just say, oh, he was racist, and then just leave it at that. You can really use his character not to support racism, but to teach about racism and make sure you're not honoring this figure, but you're just using this figure to teach your students about the time period.
So let me ask you guys one question. So what do you think that, Willa, do you think they should rename all the buildings at Princeton?
I just think that maybe they can rename a couple, but I just think that they shouldn't, that he should not be the king of Princeton.
Thanks, guys. This is Simon Leitner, signing off.
Hi, it's Ula again. Here's Max Viviano, introducing our next author.
My name is Massimo Viviano, and I'm here introducing Sofia Suarez, who's going to be reading her historical fiction piece on a young girl surviving the Holocaust.
Living in a nightmare, always on the run, pretending you're someone you're not so that people won't kill you, hiding, not saying a word, always terrified. That's what it was like for me and Abigail, always living in fear. I remember when I used to be able to live, really live, without having to worry about becoming nothing. Then all I could do was worry because my sister and I, our lives were always at stake. Last I remember, when I asked Mr. Smith a date, he said, "Doesn't matter now, dear. You shouldn't be counting the days you've lived. You should be counting the days you have left. He stopped coming so often to check up on me and Abigail after the Nazi officers asked him why he would go into the barn continuously, the barn where he hid my family, until our parents left. They just ran away one day. Mother and father were trying to protect us, trying to hide us, but they didn't know that there wasn't anywhere to hide. Eliza, Abigail whispered, the hay is scratching my legs. I know, Abigail, I respond, but don't move. If the bad guys find us, they'll take us away. Okay. Abigail's world was full of treacherousness. She was born into this nightmare only 4 years ago, already living in terror. All her memories are of us hiding from the bad people. She had no idea what it was like to live, to actually be something. When Mr. Smith had come into the barn that day, he had taken me by surprise. He hadn't come in to check on us in what seemed like a week, but who really knew? What surprised me most was hearing more than one voice. I swear, I'm not hiding anyone. If I knew where those wretched people were, I would bring them to you right away. Not a doubt in my mind that I wouldn't, exclaimed a voice a lot like Mr. Smith's. I had a voice in German respond. There was only one possibility. A Nazi soldier was in the same room as us, breathing the same air as us. I looked over to see Abigail, her eyes wide with fear. About to say something when I put my hand over her mouth, muffling her whimpers. I heard the barn door close and figured that we were alone again, but Mr. Smith's head came into view and said quietly, "Girls, before your parents left, they made me promise to keep you safe. You are no longer safe. You must run into the cornfields, over the bridge, then into the woods. I'm so sorry. You must run now. Go." I grabbed Abigail's hand, jumped up, and started running. Through the cornfields, then over the bridge, he had said. I turned to see Mr. Smith trying to distract the soldier, but the soldier pushed Mr. Smith to the ground before shooting him. I began picking up the pace, pushing corn stalks out of my way. By then, I was practically pulling Abigail when her dress got caught on a thorn bush. I could see the Nazi getting closer and closer, refilling his gun. I pulled even harder on Abigail's dress, seeing the bridge through a clearing, and finally got Abigail's dress free. I ran to the beginning of the bridge with Abigail and said, "Abigail, you have to run over the bridge. You must run into the woods." She took off just as the Nazi soldier came up behind me and tried to grab me. I elbowed him in the stomach. He doubled over but took a couple of shots before hitting the ground. The bullets missed me completely, so I looked back at him lying on the ground. That was when I heard the most hair-raising scream that I have ever heard. I started running into the woods only to find Abigail in the dirt, a pool of blood beginning to surround her. I picked her up and put her into my lap. She was crying, so I started crying too. Blood caked my hands, the blood of an innocent little girl who didn't do anything. "Abigail, please don't leave me," I said between sobs. I can't lose you. Not now. Don't go." Her little hand grabbed mine, her voice barely even a whisper, said, "I don't want to go. Please help me. Don't let me go, Eliza. Don't let go." I closed my eyes, hoping it would stop the tears and the pain. I put my head onto her chest, feeling her heart beating slower and slower. Her grip loosened, and I lifted my head, seeing the last of her life drain from her bright blue eyes. I held her frail body to mine, soaked in blood. I whispered back, "I won't let go. Not now, not ever." The soldier came up behind me and grabbed my hair to pull me up. Abigail's body fell out of my arms and onto the ground. "Don't hurt her," I said to him, but he didn't care. "She's dead," he spit back. "Can't hurt something that's already dead." He pushed me in front of him, his gun to my back, threatening to shoot at any moment. He guided me to a truck where he put me in the back and told me to stay quiet or else he would shoot. I obeyed, even though I had nothing left to live for, no one to care for, no one to love. It was like part of me was gone. It was like I was missing a piece of being something. I must have fallen asleep because when I opened my eyes, I was in a long car filled with many other shadows. A voice next to me says, By the time they let us out of this cattle train, our daughters will have children of their own. Exactly. But once they let us out, you know, they'll lock us up somewhere else, responded another voice. I asked into the darkness, where are we going? Where are they taking us? Someone answered, they're taking us to one of their camps, probably. One of their camps? Who else is on this cattle train? I ask again. Women and children only. Some children only 1 year old. Children only 1 year old. Younger than Abigail. Abigail, I feel the dried blood on my dress. I can only picture her lifeless little body. She didn't deserve to die. She was only 4 years old. She never even got to see the world for what it should have been, where we didn't always have to hide or run from people. After what felt like hours, the train finally stopped. A bunch of Nazi officers came out of a big building and opened the lock to our car. They let us into the building and into a cell in which they locked us into. I hadn't eaten or drank anything in about 2 days and wasn't expecting any food. I walked up to a corner of the cell and just sat. I wanted to scream and cry. I was becoming nothing. Mother and father had left. They just abandoned us. Abigail was dead, even though she hadn't done anything wrong. I let myself cry, but no one comforted me. I had no one left. Everyone I loved was gone. Those parts of me were gone. I cried myself to sleep that night. I was shaken awake by someone. They pulled me to my feet and pushed me out of the cell and into a line. When I got up to a desk, a tall man with scissors cut off my hair. A Nazi officer then stamped the numbers 9741 onto my arm. He handed me a black and white suit, then said, change into this. So I did. I was surrounded by people who looked exactly like me. They put us in suits, making us look like we were in jail, like we were the villains who had to be locked up to protect people from us. The Nazi officers told us they would come back for us. They told us we were going to take showers. The officers filed us into a room, telling us to keep our arms up. They said with our arms up, more people would fit. Once we were all inside, they locked the doors. Why would they lock us in the showers? But we weren't taking showers. The walls were all dented and scratched from people trying to get out. A fizzing sound came from the showers. People around me started screaming. Others were turning red and falling to the floor. I tried holding my breath, but when I couldn't any longer, my lungs filled with poison. I felt like my lungs were collapsing. I couldn't breathe. I think I have to let go, Abigail. That's when everything went black. My nightmare was over. I didn't have to worry about running anymore. I was finally free. I'd become nothing.
Thank you, Sophia. So now I'm going to be asking you a couple of questions on your piece. So first off, what prompted you to pick Nazi Germany as the background for your piece?
I chose Nazi Germany as my background because I felt like it was such an important topic to cover and I could really go into it.
Thank you. So my second question is, your main character seems to be really reliant on her friends, and once they died, she was just kind of, she didn't know what to do with her life. So I just wanted to know, did you base her off somebody, or did you decide to make her up completely?
I sort of based my main character off of myself because I find that I am not reliant on other people, and I wanted to have a character who was the opposite of me.
Thank you. So you made your main character in the end, you made her die. Is there a reason that you made her die, or did you just decide to end the piece there?
I found that my main character didn't really have a reason to continue living, so I felt that her life without her family would really come to an end sooner than later.
I'm Lily Clark with Person on the Street. I'm here today with Afnan, Tasnia, Max, and Pearl. Early last Sunday morning, in the middle of a weekend many cities were using to celebrate gay pride, a gunman armed with an assault rifle entered an Orlando, Florida nightclub. The nightclub, Pulse, was popular with Orlando's LGBT community, and it happened to be Latin Drag Night. The gunman, Omar Mateen, an American citizen with allegedly homophobic viewpoints and ties to the Islamic fundamentalist terrorist organization ISIS, opened fire, killing 50 people and wounding 53 others. This is now the largest mass shooting in American history. The students at MS51 here in Brooklyn, New York are heartbroken over this violent act of hatred against LGBT Americans and their friends and families. We are horrified and perplexed by the legal issues surrounding the banning of such assault weapons and nervous and sympathetic to our Muslim peers, teachers, and friends. I'm a member of the LGBT community, and this trauma left me speechless. This act of violence is taking a huge toll on the LGBTQ+ community, both in Orlando and around the country. What happened has taken away a sense of safety for people in a previously safe space, and it really sucks. But what happened is so detrimental and heartbreaking to the members of our community. I hope this catastrophe won't create tension between two marginalized groups because of the gunman's ethnicity. Today, I'll be asking many people on the street, Afnan, Tasnia, Max, and Pearl, what they are thinking and feeling in the wake of this tragedy. I'm here now with Max. How does this make you feel?
Disgusted. I think it's a terrible hate crime and it shouldn't have ever happened.
How do you feel about this hate crime against the LGBT community specifically?
I think it's unfair, and America is about freedom and not about hate.
What do you think the government should do to regulate guns?
I think the government should do more extensive background checks and they should choose only specific weapons that can be carried.
Thank you, Max. I'm here with Tasnia. How do you feel about this hate crime against the LGBT community?
I feel that it shouldn't have happened, and it was just like something that was very unfortunate to especially like that community.
America has the highest rate of gun murder in the world. Why do you think this is?
Because people can just get guns from like anywhere, and there's not like really a limit, or like they don't like background check about how many guns they have.
What should the government do to regulate guns?
Limit as many guns as you can, or don't even give guns out if it's not useful to that person. Like if it's not going to do something that's important.
I'm here with Afnan. What effect might this have on your life as a Muslim teenager?
The effect that this incident has on my life as a Muslim teen is that this really is a huge issue. Now, since the shooter, Omar Mateen, comes from a Muslim background, people are targeting us Muslims. Omar Mateen was disconnected with his family. They weren't really intact. He had a divorced wife, and the biggest thing is that he's gay himself, and he went to the club all the time, but soon kept on getting kicked out. He soon took his rage out on the club, but in the last second, which was completely random, he pledged allegiance to ISIS, which is very irrelevant. Now, the effect that this has on my life is that now everyone will think all Muslims are terrorists, and that's not true, because now people might call me names and bully me for being a devoted Muslim. This guy, who is really crazy, no doubt, is now showing and portraying an image of Muslims in a bad way. He made a huge mistake, and now people think we are all terrorists and we hate LGBT people. I can promise you none of that is true. The media is one of the ways they get a sense about people, even without meeting them. It disappoints me that people think we are terrorists, that all Muslims are, but no, we're not. There are some extremists who take religion too far, meaning they would kill anyone who isn't Muslim. But specifically in the Quran, our holy book, it says murdering and killing people is a huge sin, and you are not considered a Muslim anymore. On another note, we Muslims respect all kinds of people. This just really outrages me, and I wish I can help all the Muslims who try so hard to clear the false name.
How do you feel about guns?
I feel that people have too much power. I feel that they have like easy access to them, and I feel like there should be more gun control rather than people like picking it up from eBay and stuff.
How do you feel about this hate crime against the LGBT community?
I think it lowers their self-confidence about being lesbian or gay, because in America, in a lot of states, you can feel very strong and you don't need to feel scared. But I think now lesbian and gay or other sex orientations are scared that something like this is going to happen to them. I think that guns are way too out of control in America right now, and I think that there should be stricter laws on them, and only, you know, police officers. There have even been problems with police officers and gun use, so I think there really need to be stricter laws, and people need to be very careful with them, and they're not something that any citizen is allowed to have.
What do you think the government should do to regulate guns?
I think that there should be more serious background checks, because the people that have committed these hate crimes using guns have there's been a tendency for them to have mental disabilities. So I think there should be serious background checks, and definitely background checks online should start, because many people can purchase guns online and there will be no safety checks, and the people selling the guns won't know anything about them and not know that there may be a chance that the person buying the gun is going to do something dangerous and kill many people like they did in this case.
Thank you, Pearl. This is Lily Clark signing off with Person on the Street.
Welcome to the Good Batch of Books segment. I'm Lauren, and today you'll be hearing all about two fabulous books. Hopefully this will give you an idea of what to read when you're bored or in the mood for a fantastic novel. Today you'll be hearing Kai and Emily's reviews. To start us off, we have Kai Shields' exceptional review of The Prisoner of Night and Fog.
Prisoner of Night and Fog by Anne Blankman was an astounding, captivating, suspenseful, and illustratively descriptive historical novel. Integrated into an amazing plot were complex characters, fascinating plot twists, and beautiful imagery. Prisoner of Night and Fog tells the story of Gretchen Mueller, a teenage girl in Munich, Germany, during the 1930s. Though the city is on the brink of war, Gretchen stays within the protective presence of her Uncle Dolph. To her, Uncle Dolph is a beloved second father, never failing to ease her mind and protect her from the forbidding danger which snakes through the city. And yet, to the rest of the world, Uncle Dolph is the dangerous Adolf Hitler. Gretchen has grown up as Uncle Dolph's sunshine, his favorite pet, with her beautiful Aryan features and true German behavior constantly doted upon. Knowing nothing but the comforting safety of the party, Gretchen sees no falsehood in all or any of Uncle Dolph's beliefs until she meets Daniel. A bold Jewish newspaper reporter, Daniel brings Gretchen to a disorienting reality. Her beloved father, forever respected as a Nazi mater, didn't sacrifice himself for Hitler. In truth, he was murdered by a mysterious soldier. With this secret on her shoulders, Gretchen discovers another side to the party, one she's never seen or suspected was there. As Gretchen's knowledge increases, she's mystified by the horrifying truth behind her father's death. Through investigation, Gretchen not only discovers the hidden facts of her father's murder, but the stranger of Adolf Hitler underneath familiar Uncle Dolph. While Gretchen struggles to uncover the truth, she encounters corruption in places she presumed secure, foes where she once saw friends, and even love in places she never imagined. Gretchen was a multi-faced main character, and her personality consistently developed as the story progressed, making interpreting her even more engaging. Her awareness of the events around her were a large and influential factor in how she evolved over the course of the story. Gretchen faces both complicated and internal and external conflicts. Concerning internal, Gretchen, when meeting Daniel and coming to closer terms with him, battles her confusion of her initial beliefs. Uncle Dolph, in the past, constantly reminded her of the supposed subhuman Jews and how they were the cause of the turmoil facing Germany. However, to Gretchen, Daniel is no more subhuman than she is, and Gretchen finds it hard to break free of the party's delusional beliefs, which, for so long, she took pride in being a part of. As an external issue, Gretchen fears discovery by her Uncle Dolph to uncover the truth of her father's death. Overall, Prisoner of Night and Fog by Anne Blankman was a fascinating novel due to complex characters and a complicated but consistent plot. I would rate this book 5 stars and recommend it to readers who enjoy historical fiction or are interested in World War II.
Thanks, Kai. That was great. The last book review for today is brought to you by Emily Zass. This amazing novel is completely different from The Prisoner of Night and Fog. Let's start.
The novel The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown is a thrilling mystery that truly lives up to the praise and fantastic reputation that it has received. The story was very interesting to me because I love riddles and puzzles, and there are many of these throughout the plot. I even found myself guessing and solving the riddle before the characters did. I was fascinated by the unpopular points of view voiced by the characters, which I had never heard before. There was even a point in the book where they described many unknown facts about hidden codes within a painting, and I found myself Googling the painting to see exactly what the author was describing. This book is a great quick read if you're looking for a thrilling mystery. The plot of the story is centered around the popular history of the Holy Grail, what it is, and frankly, whether or not it actually exists. The story revolves around the mysterious death of Jacques Saunier, an elderly curator at the Louvre in Paris. Jacques was part of a secret society, the Priory of Sion, and he had a huge secret to keep about the Grail, but everyone else who knew the truth had been murdered. Knowing he was the last person who would ever know the true story, awaiting his murder, he realizes that he must pass on the secret to somebody, but the secret cannot be revealed to the world. Once he is dead and the police are called in to analyze his body, oddly arranged, spread out in a starfish position with coded writing in blood on his body, they call in Sophie Naveau. Sophie is a French cryptologist who coincidentally happens to be Jacques' granddaughter, and she concludes that her late grandfather was attempting to send her some kind of message. Adding to the confusion, there is writing on Jacques' body that says, P.S. Find Robert Langdon. Robert Langdon, a symbologist at Harvard, had never so much as spoken to Jacques, but as soon as the police see his name, they immediately add him as a prime suspect of the murder. Sophie and Robert are then forced together on the run from the police, and also some mysterious albino character named Silas. You'll understand more about Silas if you've read the book, all the while attempting to decode the riddles left behind that all lead to one man, Leonardo da Vinci. The main characters, Robert and Sophie, have a strange relationship throughout the course of the book. At first, Robert just pities Sophie because the police captain, Fash, is extremely sexist and looks down upon her, even though she was correctly decoding the puzzle. As the story progresses, Robert begins to envy her bravery and her quick ability to think of what to do next. This makes perfect sense, though, because Robert Langdon is especially knowledgeable of the concept of the sacred feminine, which is a belief that women are equal to or even better than men. Two other men that believed in this concept, Jacques Saunier and Leonardo da Vinci. Robert and Sophie then find it necessary to confide every piece of knowledge to each other, a level of trust and understanding bonding them together no matter what happens. Robert appreciates Sophie and Sophie appreciates Robert. The Da Vinci Code was a great book overall. There were some boring moments I found, especially those chapters involving Silas or Bishop Aringa Rosa, because I really just wanted them to solve the case. The chapters with Robert and Sophie really drew me in, though. Also, there was a weird point in the middle where the story turns really religious and violent, which was a bit uncomfortable for me. But the story made up for that with the interesting facts about art in Paris, two topics I absolutely love. I gave this book a 5-star rating because it was really fascinating and kept me wanting to read more.
Thanks, Emily. You can find these novels on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble's, or your local bookstore. This is Lauren signing off from your Good Batch of Books review segment. I hope you enjoyed it.
Recently, our 7th grade classes have been studying and immersing ourselves in the world of bullying. What it is, how and where and when it happens, and most importantly, discussing how and even if a cycle of abuse can be stopped. Today, we're pleased to present some 7th grade reflections on their personal experiences with bullying. These responses are anonymous due to sensitive subject matter and not read by the authors themselves. Here are Haley, Lauren, Pearl, Nick, Bella, and Shane, each reading a reflection.
Sitting on the bleachers with A. Let's call my friend A. We were watching people run. This is a time where the kids who are absent could run, or the unfit kids could try to do it again. In the nature of every middle schooler, you always try to find one bad thing about someone. Even if it's, why does she have that backpack? But I don't like it. But why? To make yourselves feel better, I guess. But while you're making yourself feel better, you're bringing someone else down. Anyway, this one kid stood out for me, an A. We instantly started laughing. Why is his stomach jiggling, I say. Look at his glasses falling on his face, A says. A could keep on going, but I needed to stop. Wait, I stop A. Aren't we being kind of mean? It's not being mean, it's just a fact. I can't believe it, I let her say that. If A and I are laughing and talking about this kid, then someone else in this gym class is too. I feel so guilty to this day because I wouldn't want people calling me unfit or that my stomach jiggles. And believe me, both of these things don't apply to me. Also, what annoys me is that I don't know his whole story. He could have health problems or anxiety. I have anxiety about doing things in gym, especially the pacer, and that limits me. I know people talk about me and say those same exact things, and it hurts. I know people say that I'm unfit because I can't do the pacer, and it really brings me down because they don't know my whole story. So why am I doing this to this one guy? I just want to say that I feel so guilty and I'm sorry.
I have this friend who I've known for almost a decade. We're really close, but sometimes she really gets on my nerves. I don't think she means it, but I can't help but feel that she does it on purpose. You see, she does this thing when wherever I buy some candy and I offer her some, she always reads the ingredients, making me feel bad about myself for eating it. I have told her countless times that it bothers me, but either it just doesn't sink in or she's doing it to hurt me. Now, same friend. She's super smart and sometimes I can be a little mean about it. For example, sometimes when she's talking about something I don't understand, I get jealous and laugh or call her a nerd. It never seems to affect her, but I can't help but feel guilty. Also, she's constantly getting better grades than me, so anytime I do better than her, I tease her just so I can feel a little better, even though deep down I know it's wrong.
I've always been a bully, a leader, a controller, but mostly I just bully myself. Nothing I do is good enough in my opinion. Not for myself, not for others. This is what I fool myself into thinking. It's not what I believe. Instead of hurting others, I hurt myself. I tell myself that even though I have nice eyes, hair, and lips, and cheekbones, that they don't all fit on my face, and that the features that I actually like about myself just make me ugly. No matter what it is, it's never enough. I always have to do better, and I'm never good enough. But the bully inside me constantly reminds me of the abs I used to have, the events I used to win, how easy it all was before questioning, how when I grew up, my nose got bigger, how it used to be when I didn't have anxiety. But the messed up part is that this stupid bully is here to stay, and I can't do anything to stop it.
We would always run. Every lunch we would run from him. I don't know why we ran from him. Maybe it was because we thought he was annoying. Where are we going for lunch? I would say, La Villa, but don't tell Joe, says my friend. Where are you going for lunch? Joe would ask. I would lie, say we were going to Chinese or tacos, and then we would run from him. He would be confused and would probably eat alone. Because of us, because of me. I didn't do anything to stop them from not letting him come with us. Whenever we went to Juan's house, and there was too many people, Joe was the first voted out, always, and he will leave to be alone. He thought I was his friend, I thought he was my friend, but he wasn't, and I knew it, and I hated it, but I let it happen.
I remember when a rumor was spread amongst a few people. I didn't even know who the people were. I'm the quietest person in class, and I barely spoke to most of the kids in the same class as me, let alone anyone out of class. Yet, somehow, a completely untrue rumor was spread. I learned about it when I was in homeroom, getting ready to go home. A girl from sixth grade came up to me and asked, "Hey, is it true that you asked blank out on a date?" "Excuse me?" I responded. She'd named my crush. I didn't talk to this girl. When I asked her where she got this information from, she said it was a long train. A long train? I don't talk to anyone. I hated this. I never included myself in gossip. I hated gossip. Although, thank God, it blew over the next day. I was terrified and so confused. I hated it.
Whenever I play football at lunch, I usually hang out with the same people. Once in a while, some new people come and we let them play. Once in a while, some of these new people play and they don't really know who's good or bad. But that doesn't bother me. What does bother me is when the new people make fun of me for dropping a pass or making a bad throw, which I don't really care about until my usual friends that I always play with start ganging up on me, also saying, "You're trash and you can't catch." It just gets me frustrated. There's always just one or two friends that I know wouldn't say those things about me. Then one of them does, and now I'm wondering if this person is truly my friend and wouldn't just make fun of me to be with the group. Why do I even play with these guys?
Today, we're having
having an open and honest chat about bullying. Adults, you may want to turn up your radios. You're about to get some interesting insight into the world of middle schoolers. I'm here today with
Bella,
Lauren,
Simon,
Shane,
Nick,
Lily,
Haley,
and Izzy, the associate producer of this podcast.
And here we go. What do you think is a good way to prevent someone from being bullied?
I feel like there isn't really a way to prevent someone from being bullied because it just kind of happens. Like, if you're introduced to a new school and if someone just doesn't like you off the top of their head, it's just like human nature to dislike somebody else.
There's no like solid way to prevent bullying like once and for all. There are like little ways you can help someone just get through being bullied. Like you can reach out to people that you think are being targeted and try to make friends with them, and then it's harder. Like strength in numbers is what I kind of think about when I think about preventing bullying.
How would you describe a bully?
I think a bully is someone that teases you to the point that you personally feel bad and it affects your life every day and you're thinking about it so much that it makes you cautious, and so cautious that you just can't, it's hard to almost live, and that's where it gets very serious, and that's what I think a bully is. I think bullies could be anywhere. They could be like, if you're older, it could be in your workplace. It could be someone that makes you feel like you're not good at your profession. Someone that just makes you feel bad about what you do.
Adding on, I think bullying can literally be anywhere that has Wi-Fi due to social media. So someone can just send you something like they hate you, or they don't like you, and they just try to hurt you anywhere you are.
It depends on what you mean by bully. There's the bully who's your friend and just teases you about the clothes you wear. And then there's the bully who's only mean to you behind your back, so you never really know. And the other kind of bully is the bully who will walk up to you and say to your face, "You're stupid, you deserve to die." Because to the person being bullied, that is the real bully. Not the one who they never heard the comments they said, not the one who just teases them sometimes, but the person who really hurt them, the person who scarred them for life because they couldn't keep their mouth shut.
Visually, I think that like a bully could be anybody, anybody who holds a grudge or just anyone who has this hate in their life that they want to take it out on somebody else, whether it's for a reason or it's just for no reason. And bullying can be anonymous.
Tell me a bit about anonymous bullying.
I don't do much social media, but I have a lot of friends who do. And there's an app called AskFM where you can ask people anonymously questions. And usually people use this so that you can't actually tattle on them. You can't tell people who's bullying you because you don't know.
Because
their names aren't there.
They could almost say anything. They could say about your appearance, about what you do, what you do and how well you are, like how well you do it. If you're really bad at it, they might make fun of you, or you know, if you're fat, they might say you're really fat, and like they might make you feel bad. But I think the possibilities are really just infinite, and that's another problem.
I think anyone on AskFM is sort of like a ghost to you because you don't know who it is, and they can sort of say anything they want, and it can affect you in ways that they don't understand.
I think that social media is one of the biggest targets to bully because you're given a big variety. You have all these words. Your fingers can do anything you want to make people feel awful about themselves, and I think the power gets to everybody's heads and they use it in the wrong way.
What does it feel like to be teased about how you look?
Well, I mean, it makes you feel awful, like you're doing something wrong because of the way you look or just because of something you do. It's not like you can change the way you look. look because that's the way you were born. But if someone thinks that there's something wrong with that, they will take that and they will bully you about it because they find something in themselves that they hate. And they need to take it on someone else so that they don't feel bad.
So I think that one of the it's mostly girls that worry about what they look like, it seems. I mean, in my experience. So we're usually looking for approval from guys, and that's what everyone tells us to do. But I think that when people learn that they can validate themselves is when things really start to make a change.
A lot of people say, like, you dress to impress, but, like, we're in middle school, and I don't think there's any need to be dressing to impress anyone.
A lot of times when I'm in the boys' locker room or something, I often hear some guy, like, yelling at another guy, oh, you don't have abs. Oh, you aren't strong. And then it gets into fights and stuff, which is really stupid. I don't have to be strong. Mentally, I'm strong already, and I'm probably more strong than they are if they're trying to, like, make fun of me.
Girls and boys see celebrities and models who are photoshopped to look perfect. So, by impress, do they mean impress us and make yourself look beautiful the way these artificial people look? Or do they mean impress yourself by looking the way you want to look and looking the way you should look?
When you're being bullied, when is the appropriate time to get an adult involved?
I think sometimes getting an adult involved in like bullying is not really the best idea, because normally it depends on what their childhood was like. If they've been bullied, then they kind of know more like that. But if they haven't, then they don't really understand that well.
I think you should tell an adult the second it starts happening, because if you don't, it'll start to get worse and worse and worse, and then it'll just be much harder because they'll be more afraid. So the second someone starts to pick on you, you should go tell an adult, because then it will stop as soon as it starts.
I think that it's hard to tell an adult when you're getting bullied, because if you think about it, really, what can they do? I mean, you can suspend this person, you can suspend the bully, you can, in some cases, you can't even really find out who the bully is, but they'll probably, if you're like getting bullied on social media, this adult might like take you off social media. If you're getting bullied at school, administration is just going to punish the bully. They're just going to get more angry.
Just adding on to Lauren, I feel like when you're trying to stop a bully from doing what they do best, you really can't do anything, because no matter what you do, they still can bully you, and it sort of just gets to the point where you can't do anything else.
So I have two things to add on. One thing about what Shane said, he said something about how it depends on the adult, and I think that's really important, that if you do want to find an adult, you have to find the right adult, because you don't want to go to somebody that you don't really know and you don't really trust, and they don't know you that well, they don't know your personalities and what you might be getting bullied about. And something else, adding on to Lauren, is that she said, like, even if they suspend you, you know, like social media again, just they could be miles away and they could still be bullying you.
Why is it so easy to end up being the bystander?
I think that it is very easy to end up being the bystander, because you don't really want to be in the position that the person being bullied is in, and you think, oh, they'll solve it some way, somehow, and you really, you don't want to be bullied, you don't want to be the victim if you don't have to be.
I think it's easy to be a bystander because no one, it's like, what can you really do? If you are there and you just try to help, you're going to end up being that adult that both of them hate, and then you're going to be stuck in an even worse situation than everyone else.
But I think the more important question is, if you get involved, do you have a chance to help that person? And more often than not, the answer is yes, because when a person is bullied, a lot of their friends leave them alone and they kick them to the curb because they don't want to be bullied in the same way, and they don't want to have any part in that. They don't want to feel the way you do because they're scared. But if one person, one bystander, cannot be scared for even 5 minutes and help someone being bullied, it could save that person's life.
What do you think as a middle schooler is one thing you wish adults knew about bullying?
I think adults don't really know what bullying is like today just because they're older than us, but also they haven't been in the situation that we are in, and so they don't really understand what we're going through.
Adults now don't really realize that on social media it's a lot different than just someone who you're seeing face to face, like what might have happened when they were a kid, and so they kind of forget what it feels like to feel that like empty and to feel someone targeting you specifically and just like breaking you down. And so I wish that they knew that it's more complicated now and like there's more layers to it than they really think.
I agree. There are so many more ways that you can be bullied now, so many new things that have come up since they were kids that could influence you, and like social media and texting that could just break you down so much more, like in so many different ways and just so much more than back then. But I also feel like, just like to kind of disagree, that adults do know what bullying feels like, because I feel like we've all been bullied in some way and we've all kind of been the victim and we might even all been the bully. So I feel like we all do know how horrible it is, and that sometimes we should just maybe give them a chance to understand it a little more.
Yeah, I think bullying has changed. It's mutated in a sort. It's gone from putting someone in a trash can to telling them, calling them mean names and making them want to commit suicide by texting them something. Well, I don't know about you guys, but my parents do not do much social media, mostly because they can't really figure it out. So there's a lot of the time where they don't really understand what's going on. If someone asks you on Ask FM, but doesn't actually ask you anything, says like, you're a loser, why are you not killing yourself, something like that, the adults don't really realize what's going on, and they don't know how to stop it.
I wish adults would stop doing stupid stop bullying rallies and ads and stuff like that, because it just doesn't help. And the truth is, like, no matter how many of those rallies you hold, it's really just something that everyone experiences. And if you're a bully, you kind of just, you're not going to be stopped by a rally. And it's like, you're going to be like, everyone's unified, you know? We all take bullies together. It's like, if you don't know someone, you're not going to go help them out. And even if they're your friend, you're not really going to help them out. So I just wish adults would stop pretending like those help.
I think that no matter how hard they try to understand bullying in the ways of technology, I don't think they're going to realize, like, if I think they, a lot of adults think texting is the equivalent to sending letters in their day, but if someone sent you a ton of letters saying kill yourself, then you can just recycle them and maybe they'll turn into something useful. But for texting, they really just don't go away.
What adults don't realize is that social media and the internet has become our lives. If we're not allowed to go on social media because there's a bully, it not only will make it worse, but you're shutting down our social life. So not only are we becoming bullied, but we're becoming outcasts. We're becoming that kid that doesn't have social media that everyone makes fun of. Because in our world, that's what's important. Because this is a new world. This isn't the world where kids are pushed against the wall. This world is meaner. Because in our world, we're not hurt physically, but mentally. And while physical wounds can be healed in just a few weeks, mental wounds last you a lifetime.
Our 7th grade discussion panel. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of 7's Up.
Be sure to tune in next fall when 7's Up returns with a brand new batch of 7th grade hosts, authors, and readers.
Once again, we'd like to thank our sponsors from Donors Choose, our friends at iTunes and Audioboom. And hey, if you're listening on iTunes, could you take a minute to give us a rating and review? This will help us increase our listenership. You can do both things on your computer or through your iTunes app.
Sevens Up is produced by Ryan Michelle Woods, and associate producer Isabel Count, who also writes some original music for each podcast.
This is Alex,
Ula,
and Maya,
signing off.